Hello and welcome. My name is Alex MacPhail and this is High Performance Teams. I'm a former aerobatics display pilot from the South African Air Force and I love talking about high performance teams, what makes them work and what we can all learn from them. In the show, we talk to race pilots, professional sportsmen and women, entrepreneurs, comedians, performing artists and more. Please enjoy and remember to subscribe.
Good afternoon to you. Welcome. What a wonderful day it is. From stage 5 down to stage 4, I had a wonderful morning. I took my son and my dog for a run. It was great to get out and about. Oh, sunshine, stretching our legs, seeing so many neighbors, obviously keeping our social distance, and just seeing people being active. It's wonderful. It feels like today is Freedom Day and not Workers' Day. I've got a great guest lined up for you today. Oh, man. Introductions. I'm at a loss for words. Patrick Davidson is a Red Bull air race pilot. He's also a Red Bull athlete, and there's a difference. We're going to find out just what that means. Is the Red Bull air race continuing? Well, stay tuned. Let's have a chat. My name is Alex MacPhail, and this is High Performance Teams. Patrick, good afternoon to you. How are you doing today in Port Elizabeth?
I'm lucky. Thanks. And you, bud?
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Did you get out running this morning?
I'm going to pretend I did, but no, I didn't. We got a little baby and she kept us a little busy last night. So I let my wife sleep in a bit. So I was on daddy duty, unfortunately.
Oh, good man. Good family man. We're going to get to family in just a minute. But Patrick, we got a wonderful opportunity for a chat. Thank you for your time today. I'm looking forward to discovering all things aerobatics, Red Bull, air races, and everything in between. But for those who don't know, let's rewind the clock a little bit. Your first competition, incidentally, you won. You were 12 years old competing in competition aerobatics. So tell us a little bit about the background and how it is that a 12-year-old can compete in competition aerobatics.
Yeah, look, I've got my dad to thank, for everything that I have achieved in aviation. It's been, solely due to him to give me the opportunity. And, I think when I competed, it was at the Wild Coast Sun. And it was actually at a national championship, and there was Nikolai Timofeev, I think he's a 3-time world champion on limited level. He was out visiting, and he actually offered, instead of one of the local guys, to fly as a safety pilot for me. And obviously, I'd been doing a bit of training with my dad leading up to the event. And so obviously, I jumped at the opportunity. I jumped in the front seat of the Souk 29 because I wasn't able to fly from the rear as I had no student license or anything. And he did the takeoff and the landing with me on the controls, and the rest was up to me.
Well, it sounds wonderful. What an opportunity. And yeah, your dad is one of those legends in aviation in South Africa, Stu Davidson, and what a privilege. And now being a family man yourself, you've told me earlier that you've also exposed your children. But let's fast forward then. So you compete at a young age, and here's a picture of that newspaper article winning there at 12-year-old in the novice category of aerobatic. Well, awesome days. Fast forwarding a little bit, you go solo and get your PPL on a Harvard on your 17th birthday. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm not too sure what my dad's reasoning was for wanting me to do it. But obviously, Harvard's a very special airplane to all South Africans, especially guys in the military that did their pubes course and training on it. It's a fantastic airplane, and they don't call it the pilot maker for nothing. It was a good grounding for me. Obviously, quite a complex airplane compared to a 152 or something like that. And I did all my training for my PPL on the Harvard, and then on my 17th birthday, I was able to go solo out of PE Main. So yeah, pretty cool, huh?
Very nice. And so along the way, had you flown any of these smaller airplanes, or just flown Harvards all the way for your license?
Yak 52. I think at that point with Yak 52 and a Pitts was the only other airplane that I'd flown, to be honest. Wow. I'd flown in a number of other airplanes, but no 152s. I think I only did my 152 conversion. I don't want to lie to you, but I think it was like 2008, 2009.
Okay, so you know what it's about, but complex airplane. I'm going to put that video that you shared with us about the Harvard up there. We can have a look and see why it's such a wonderful airplane, but also hard work. So tell us about what it is about warbirds that tickles your fancy, that you guys continue to invest in them and fly them and spend time with them.
From a business perspective, they're fantastic investments. They're dollar-based assets, and like classic cars, they become more valuable the further along, the older they get. as long as you keep them in one piece, because a lot of the more valuable ones are, you know, non-insurable. So from that perspective, yeah, from a business perspective, it's a great place to have your money. They're very, very emotional airplanes. You know, people often ask me which is my favorite to fly, what's, you know, which one is my best. And, you know, it's not fair to actually ask that question, because from a perspective of each individual airplane, they each have their own emotion, they each have their own personalities, and they each have their days which they're best to fly better than any other airplane. So, you know, when you sit in them, you smell them. You know, when I get home from flying them, my wife always says to me, she's flying the Harvard, and I'll say, yeah, you have. Because there's a very specific smell, you know, to the jet, the Harvard, to the Sukhoi, to everything. Each one's got its own smell, its own personality. So in that regard, I find them quite special.
Yeah, you're speaking about the special things about like the Harvard. I live in Pretoria, not too far from Swartkop, and there's the Harvard Club. They regularly fly over, and I've already trained up the kids. You know, what's that noise? Can you hear in the background there? It's the Harvard dad. So yeah, it's a lovely. It's got
it's
a great
only one
sound.
Noise that sounds like that. Yeah.
It's lovely. Okay, so you've got a fascination. You start flying young, aerobatics. You've got a fascination with warbirds, and then you start taking it more and more seriously, and you start doing quite well, and. Result is now 5 times national champ in aerobatics in South Africa. Talk us through what it's like to prepare and be ready and be on the game for your competition day, knowing that there's the known sequence and there's an unknown. What is competition aerobatics at the top level in South Africa?
Yeah, or maybe just to reverse back a bit with regards to the preparation, you know, to these events. You know, everyone says that, yeah, they want to be a champion, they want to do this, and, you know, they want to excel at whatever sport. Doesn't necessarily have to be flying, but a lot of people aren't prepared to give up the, to sacrifice the time, the effort, and, you know, the pain, because, you know, essentially the same as any other sport, to fly hardcore aerobatics, it hurts. You know, when you haven't trained for a while and you start pushing, you know, minus 10 and, you know, pulling, you know, plus 10, plus 11, whatever it is, you know, you expose your body with no G-suit to those sort of forces, it hurts. You know, it's really, it's an uncomfortable position to be in until you build up a tolerance where you can sort of do it flight after flight. So, yeah, a lot of people don't want to give it up. And, yeah, the time and effort that goes into it, obviously it's important to have a good team on your side. You know, my wife luckily supported me with the flying from day one, so I'm very fortunate in that regard. But, you know, my dad's always been there to help me. He's been my coach, my mentor, you know, especially on the aerobatic side of things. You know, when I fly, I very seldom fly without him on the ground. On the radio, you get to a point where you can actually start teaching yourself bad habits. So it's quite important to have a good team behind you that can assist and guide you, you know, from regardless of what level that you're at. Even at unlimited level, I'm still learning every time I fly, you know, by somebody telling me something or my dad mentioning something and going up and trying it. So, yeah, I find the preparation and the team behind you is probably key to any success.
Okay, great. It's nice to have that support behind you, and easy when you've got a father where you share the same passion as your father and he's done the same thing. He's also a champion in his time. But, okay, so you've built up to a level, you're regularly competing at the top level, and you start taking some victories. But, you know, obviously it's not just a smooth build and step up, and there's setbacks along the way. So have you had some of these setbacks along the way? How has it gone? You know, how does a champion get to the top?
Yeah, I mean, it's time and effort. You know, it's time in the saddle. That's what you got to do to get to the top. Yeah, just coming back one step, there's something that jumped into my mind there. We were busy doing a training camp, and myself, Barry Eels, and Leela Gonahy were training actually at Utenate just outside of PE. And, you know, you say it's nice to have my dad there, and it is. It's fantastic. But he's a hard man. Anyone that knows him in business and with training will know that he gets his pound of flesh. But yeah, I was busy doing a sequence and I'd actually made a mistake or whatever, and I'd reset, and, you know, sort of before the time that I'd reset, he was so annoyed at me that he'd actually jumped in the plane and he was already taking off by the time that I'd like turned back into to run into the box, because he said he wanted to go watch the Grand Prix. I was wasting his time. So yeah, just to put it in perspective how hardcore he is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That is proper.
Tell us about what these aircraft are like to handle. You've been through a range of them, and they're getting very, very sophisticated lately.
Yeah, I mean, the Sukhoi's, you know, it's like the benchmark of competition aerobatics. It's a very tough airplane to build. to beat. When they built the aeroplane, they basically said they wanted an aeroplane that would beat all other aircraft in aerobatics, and there was literally there was no budget to it. So it's built up out of titanium and carbon Kevlar, and it really it is even for its age, it's a work of art. But the new airplanes that are coming onto the scene are obviously a lot easier to handle. The Souk having a radial engine, using a lot of oil, having to pull it through before you started to circulate the oil around the engine, so you don't have a hydraulic lock, those sort of things. Not having accurate fuel gauges and reliable and inverted commas systems, because they've never actually let me down. But the Souk specifically has got quite an interesting feed from the wing tanks to the main, where you use the wing tanks, but the excess gets pumped back into the main tank. And once the main tank's full, it then pumps it overboard. But there's actually no way of telling that it's going overboard. So it's a bit of a know your aeroplane type of game. Whereas, something like the Game Bird, you've got 5 hours worth of endurance at 210 knots, which is all displayed on the G3X touchscreen, and it's just so easy to move around. So yeah, they've developed a lot. Generally, the tailwheel aeroplanes, people say, are quite difficult to fly. Maybe I'm not the right person to ask, because I don't really know much else. For me, I love the characteristics of them, the amount of control that you've got, the power to weight ratios, the performance, and just the coolness of them. They're fun to fly.
Yeah, it looks like fun. And bearing in mind that what you mentioned earlier, the bruises and the pains, that you have to get used to that first. So I'm going to put a picture up of you buzzing down the beachfront Maitland there in your SU-31. We've got some Eastern Cape people tuned in today. Sivo from the Falcons of yesterday, he's from the Eastern Cape. He said, "Lekker, Patrick, Eastern Cape boys. What is it like to fly in your hometown doing the thing you love doing?"
Yeah, with aerobatics and flying in general, there's people that love it and there's people that hate it. Where we're based at Seaview, there's been a massive following of my accolades or my achievements, and the guys have been really supportive. But there has been a few bad apples that don't enjoy the noise, if you can call it a noise. They don't enjoy the idea of somebody buzzing around and burning money or gas, whichever way you want to look at it. So it has its ups and downs, but for me, being able to fly an air show, and I'm so bleak about this lockdown. I know it was necessary, but I literally had back-to-back air shows from now right through until September. So I put a lot of work in. A friend of mine, Baptiste Veen, came down from France, and he spent a week with us. 10 days with us early in the year. Mm-hmm. And I had a really cool air show sequence planned out, and it was all done to music and stuff, and I need to be told I'm not allowed to fly. And three of those events would have been here local in P, which would have been really cool to showcase in front of my hometown,
Oh, great. Now, it sounds exciting. The air show circuit is fun. It's awesome. But to put it back into perspective, you have a family business. You're a full-time businessman as well, and flying is not quite a sideline gig, but you have to put the bread on the table too. So tell us about the sort of industry you're in. It's high risk and complex. Are there any crossovers between what you see in performing on the edge of the envelope of an aircraft and operating in a team that functions in a complex industry?
We have a demolition earth moving company. We specialize in the demolition of concrete structures, not by using explosives. We use hydraulic hammers and pulverizers and that sort of thing. It is a risky business to be in. And when I applied for my life insurance and things like that, they were actually, to be honest, they were more concerned about me working in the demolition field than what they were doing the Red Bull Air Race, which was blew my mind. it is risky, and I find the biggest thing that that they share as a common purpose is probably discipline. There's a lot of people looking up to me. We employ about 140 odd people, and you have to make some decisions, especially in times like these, that it's not going to make everyone happy. But you have to be a constant. You have to be solid. You have to commit as well. So I think discipline and commitment is probably the two biggest things that those two industries or businesses share.
Okay, now getting back into the air show circuit. So a while ago, you're now a Red Bull athlete, and they, you know, Red Bull being a quite an exclusive company, it's got a very strong brand following around the world. Tell us what it is to be a Red Bull athlete, because not everybody, I believe, is not everyone in the Red Bull Air Race circuit are Red Bull athletes. So, what is a Red Bull athlete?
Quite an interesting question. The Red Bull Air Race is obviously something to discuss, or was something to discuss on its own. To be a Red Bull athlete, I think in any discipline is the pinnacle. Some people might argue that, but for me, a Red Bull was always a target. It was always a dream. It was always a goal, and a goal that I never thought I would actually reach, to be blatantly honest with you. So to be asked by these guys to represent them, to represent the brand, is pretty special, because then you've gotten to the top of your game. You know that they like who you are. But they also look at you not only for your accolades. I mean, obviously they want the best in the business, but they look at your saleability as a person, as an athlete, as a brand ambassador. They like the social media channels as well. You know, you have a big air show and it is great to fly there, but you might get 100,000 people. You know, Red Bull posts a video online or on Instagram, whatever it is, and all of a sudden there's 25 million views within like 12 hours, you know. So things have evolved from where it was. Sponsorships are no longer the same. You know, the social media aspect of sponsorships is just something, you know, that I can't even fathom still, and I'm involved in it daily. So, yeah, from that perspective, they're a fantastic brand to support. They're a fantastic brand to be an ambassador of. Just reverting back to what the Red Bull Air Race was, not everyone in the Air Race was a Red Bull athlete. Mm-hmm. The brand obviously was owned by Red Bull. They patented it, and it was their ideas. Peter Bessinger, obviously the godfather of Red Bull Air Race, he put this thing together, Mr. Mateschitz, and obviously their teams, and they came up with this idea. The problem with that was, you know, having all the people under that. What's the best way of explaining it? You can't have competition within a company as much as you would where there'd be competing brands. So I would say that 30% of the people there that were racing both in Challenger, between the two Challenger and Masterclass, were actually Red Bull athletes. The rest came with other sponsorships, from watches to sunglasses to all sorts of other bits and pieces. So no, we weren't all Red Bull athletes.
Okay, so it's a great prestigious achievement, and I believe, you know, in the disciplines, in a smaller country like South Africa, there is only one Red Bull athlete, and you are it, and representing the brand now. So that's great, and it's nice to see the paint schemes. The aircraft looks so striking. I'm putting a picture up of the latest toy with Tev Mountain in the background. Tell us about this new one in its Red Bull colors. It looks like a beauty to fly with, the November registration.
Yeah, I think subsequent to that photo, the registration has now changed. It's November 71 Papa Delta, just with the proving flights, we had to keep it with the Golf Charlie registration. But yeah, it's a game bird. It was designed and built by Philip Steinbach, who's partnered up with Stuart Walton, who is family of the Waltons, who own Walmart and the Macro Group and all the rest of it. So it's a good partner to have. They put a lot of money, time, and effort into building this. And, you know, as much as I would like to say it's an Esbach 2.0, it's not. It's substantially better. It's substantially faster, more fun to fly, easier to use, faster. Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. There's not a lot of them at the moment. I think they just completed serial number 17. But at this point, the Jordanian Falcons, I think we're looking into it. The Halcones have already replaced their extras with, they've already taken delivery of their game birds. And I think the Blades are also looking at it as well. Sean Tucker's ordered a number of them too. So I'm sure there'll be a big announcement for his new sponsor. So I think they're putting a formation team together, and he raves about it. So look, I mean, for me, I'm biased. I love the airplane. But others might say the extra is better, but it's a personal preference. You like Merc, I like BMW, he likes Porsche, you know, who knows?
Wow. Okay, so Red Bull Air Race. How does somebody get to the eligibility status, or put your hand up to say, pick me? How does that even come about?
Yeah, obviously with Red Bull Air Race now out the window, there's prospect of a a new race, if you will, or a new product which will be launched, which I'm sure we'll touch on just now. But yeah, I mean, they're always looking out. You know, the weird thing for me was after Red Bull South Africa proposed it to Red Bull Austria that that I become a race pilot. You know, it took about 6 to 8 weeks before they actually physically had me at a training camp over in Europe. And when I arrived there, they literally knew everything about me. And it was purely due to speaking to people, other people in the industry, aviators and things like that, but also what had been posted on Facebook. They literally knew the ins and outs, families, everything like that. So the initial brief for the initial interview was caught me on the back foot a little because I didn't realize they would have done so much homework. But anyway, they did. And I mean, to get noticed initially, you've got to obviously compete at there's two avenues which they looked at. One was actually Air Force. So you had someone like Ben Murphy, who was the leader of the Red Arrows, and then you had someone like myself who had an aerobatic background. So they're looking for outstanding sportsmanship. They're looking for special hands. They're looking for a sellable person. They're looking for somebody that excels or exceeds at what they do, you know. And for me, it was the turning point was winning the Sky Grand Prix, which Nigel Hopkins and Roger Deer put together, the first one of which was held at Durban Beachfront, and the second one also in Durban at the horse racing event there, or at the horse racing arena. And I actually won that with Rob Holland and Ord and all the rest of it. And I think that really lifted me up a little bit and really got me noticed. So they're looking for big achievements, but with that said, it's also you got to be careful what you post on your social media channels. They, if you are planning on applying to become a a sponsored athlete, I'm sure it works with all brands, but you got to watch what you're doing because they do their homework.
Right, I'm sure they do, and it's easier and easier for people to do homework now because we have such a big, wide, deep footprint on digital nowadays. Okay, so exactly. You're out there. It's not a long time. You're out there. They know a lot about you, and you start right away in the training camp. So tell us what it's like in this training camp to be eligible to compete in the Red Bull Air Race. What's the training camp like?
So it actually consisted before we even were selected. There was a training camp, and then there was a selection camp as well. As soon as you leave your room in the morning, there's a psychologist which is with us all the time, and he travels literally from table to table, and he sort of just bounces loosely between, and he's making continuous assessments. So that's obviously, it's a bit daunting because you don't know what he's actually. He's quite a straight-faced type of guy, and he was the guy also that he used to say yes or no who gets into the Austrian and German air forces. So, I mean, he's quite a hardcore guy. Sure. So you don't know what notes he's making. But, so he's bouncing around. There's a lot of psychometric testing, which they do, reaction time testing they do. They ask us also to give presentations on, random things, how a propeller governor works and, how aerodynamics works and this and that. And it wasn't necessarily, I mean, you're talking to guys that were like chief of the Air Force and, guys that have forgotten, I mean, Paul Bonham and those guys are sitting with Steve Jones and, I'm telling them about how a propeller works. I mean, but obviously the aim wasn't about the actual topic. The aim was about the presentability of the person and how you presented yourself and handled the stress and prepared as well because you had to do slideshows and all the rest of it. So, the flying was actually a small part of it. When you take off the first time and you've done all this testing, you actually don't even know. I mean, all of us know we could fly, but, you actually didn't know if you'd passed all these other tests before you actually even got to the airplane. So the flying, as soon as we got airborne, you sort of take off and you look back and, you see the track and you think there's absolutely zero chance I'm going to get this airplane to fit through all those pylons without killing myself. And, they set it up and they let you train firstly above the pylons. So you take sort of, an aircraft height above and they're not too crucial. So at least if you want to bomb out, you can sort of just without damaging anything. And because obviously the pylons are expensive as well.
Sure.
And then they work you through until you're actually flying through the whole track at that height. And then they reduce you to what we call pimple height, which is the yellow thing right on the top of there. So your head's sort of just above there. And then they drop you down to race height when they think you're capable. And yeah, you know, before you know it, you're actually flying the track and you're flying it back in reverse. The only downside is that the track doesn't remain the same. So every time you go to an event and you look down, you're like, wow, I'm not too sure about this.
Well, it sounds amazing. And I love that even at the most sort of, I mean, this is a real specialist role, sort of best of the best of only a few countries in the world gets to take part in something. And there's still these little, the colloquial terms or the inside jargon, the pimple height. I just love those kind of things. It's great. So these pylons now, obviously there's a bit of a stress around them, but I mean, they're largely bags of air, you know, in a windsock type material. Is this something that you really worry about? Like when you clip them, what happens?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's clipping a pylon and there's hitting a pylon. I've unfortunately done both. And to clip a pylon, sometimes you don't even know. So it's a precious cell. So it's basically equivalent to like a paper. You can literally, you can actually tear it. It's it's quite like permeable, if you will. You can like just pull it apart and it's no problem at all. The problem is the further down you go, the thicker it gets, because it obviously has to pull its strength from somewhere, and that's obviously the base. So, you know, if you nick one, sometimes you just look back and you actually wouldn't have felt it, but by the time that you've done a 180, you can physically see the pylons going down. But then on the other hand, we've on certain occasions, we've had them go through the propeller where they get ingested, into the engine, and you obviously start having cooling problems. We've had them that, you just hit on the underside of the spade, which comes off the aileron, which, it's sort of an external fixture. They've got cutters on them, so they've actually got blades on them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes it just happens that you hit it on the zip or something like that, and it actually, we've had one being ripped off. Also, if you hit them under loading, under G-loading, there's quite a bit of rudder movement when you're actually moving through those pylons, especially in the chicane, and you're trying to be as tight as possible. So if you hit them and they hook on the tail, because you're going that close that it just misses your head, but it hits the vertical stabilizer, then yeah, you can also be put into a negative flick quite quickly. So, you know, and obviously you're only operating like a couple of meters off the ground at like 200 knots. So things are happening pretty quick. So yeah, there is a big concern to hitting them. And also the other thing I didn't mention was that if you hit them, there's a heat transfer too. Okay. So sometimes it actually like heat welds itself onto the airplane. And if that's on a leading edge or alternatively on like the end of an aileron where you've got particles of the balloon still on there, it affects everything from the flying characteristics to the approach characteristics to the stall characteristics. Sure. And, you know, keeping in mind that majority of those strips that we're operating out of there are literally on the parameters of those airplanes, like 450, 500 meters long with really not great approaches.
Mm. Okay, so now obviously the goal is not to hit them or nick them at all. But if you have a little nick, you just carry on. But if there's some sort of welding on or obstruction, you have to bail out, or do you always have to bail out?
No, if you hit it and there's no debris or there's no direct damage to the airplane, it's your discretion. Although your heart seems to like sink quite deep into your stomach because you know what's happened, especially during the race. But there's no if you've just nicked one and the aircraft's flying fine, it's no problem. If there is an issue, we have cleared airspace above the track. And the protocol is you slow the airplane down. First of all, make sure that the airplane is still flying okay. Mm. If the aircraft's flying okay, you actually call the chopper to do an inspection, and the chopper would fly formation with you just to make sure that there's nothing hanging off. And then he would break off, and we would be basically perform a tail slide, which was to put the airplane vertical until the top of the penetration. And whichever wing had the debris on, you would put that. So basically, if it was on the right wing, you'd have left foot in, so left wing down, and vice versa. And the aircraft would then slide back, in its vertical line, and the debris would come off, and then you would return to base and land.
Okay, wow. There's a virtual or an airborne safety car, safety helicopter. It's wonderful. So they've obviously covered all the risk bases. It is a high-risk sport with small margins for error, but there's been a lot of planning about it. Okay, so we've talked about the build-up, the training, and you get to experience the course. What does a race weekend look like? So obviously there's free practice and there's qualifying, et cetera. But tell us through, I mean, people are asking questions, and please, folks, you're welcome to bring in your questions. They're asking questions like, what do you eat beforehand? Is there a specific diet and your protocol for practice, qualifying, and the race?
Yeah, so for me, no, there was no diet. I generally keep fit. I think my biggest negative, to be honest with you, was actually the jet lag. Because everywhere from Port Elizabeth is either via Cape Town or Johannesburg and then onward to another destination and generally a transit flight from there. You know, so I'd be pretty buggered by the time that I arrived there, which was like probably my worst enemy. Mm-hmm. Although they looked after us with the travel, and obviously as you carry on, you build up miles and stuff and you can start upgrading. But yeah, that was a big negative for me. So it was important to gym to make sure that I had a clear head and obviously get my oxygen going in my body. Obviously they were very strict with alcohol, so that was not even a consideration.
Okay.
I don't want to call him a chiropractor, but he was like a physio chiropractor guy, and they traveled with us to all the races, Daniel, and he had like old hands. He was really, really good. So if you had any issues when you arrived there from, sleeping badly on the plane or whatever, he would literally come in, sort you out, or even just give you a massage if you were really tired or struggling.
Great.
And then from a, from a preparation point of view, I think it's just to try and create a routine from when you get there, rest well. Wake up, have a clean mind, and be ready to race. But by the time that you get there, you're so focused on the end goal, all you want to do is hear the South African anthem on the podium. That was like, the main thing, which unfortunately never happened. I was close, but it never happened. But it's just a matter of trying to get into a routine. And, I'm lucky I don't get sick when I fly. The nerves and that are always there. But, once the visor goes down, I just got tunnel vision.
Yeah, focus. And okay, you mentioned the anthem. What's it like representing your country in a sport? I mean, you are the representative for Africa in Red Bull Air Race. What's that like putting on that? You've got the flag on your helmet, I think it is. And great. What's the feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to explain. The first race, to get in the aeroplane, and you just want to do so well. But the reality of the situation is that everyone is so very, very good there, and they're all, representing their own countries, and, we're all there for the same goal. Everyone wants to be number one. It was a fantastic opportunity for me to expose South Africa. I know Glenn Dell did it a few years before me. And I'm fortunate enough to have flown the flag, and I got a few trophies, so I hope I didn't let anyone down.
Wonderful. Okay, so the show weekend comes, you do the practice, you do the qualifying, and I know you had a good couple of results in last year's season, but it was kind of called off at the end. But talk us through the sort of preparation. So you get ready for the show, you do the race. What is the rounding out, the review, the debriefing like? How do you analyze your performance? How do you improve it? What's your method in your team?
So as a challenger pilot, you rely on your fellow challenger pilots to give you honest opinions. With the air race, we had access to review each flight with sector times as well. So after each flight, Alvaro would send us an email, which will basically be a breakdown of your each individual sector times, but as well as everyone else's sector times as well. So you could see where the next guy was faster or slower than you. And then you had the access to watch his videos as well. So, not a lot of people share their in-cockpit footage, because obviously that gives a lot away with the angle of physically what you see when you're approaching the pylon, and sure, possibly a reference on the horizon, after the turn, to see how much you need to bank in or how little you need to bank in to approach the correct angle for the next one. So I think videos was a very important part for me to learn. And also speaking to the master guys, I was at the sub-tier of the air race, and the master guys were, some of them had been there a long time, Kirby Chambliss, Mike Goulian, Ivanov, all those guys. And they were actually extremely helpful, always approachable. I got on really well with Francois Lavotte, and he let me have a few goes on his simulator, which helped a lot too. Okay. But literally, if you had a question for the guys, they would, and you didn't ask them before they were racing, they would really, take the time, explain, and it was quite a cool thing to see, to experience.
Well, it's nice to hear that, the sort of the masters of the game are willing to share. So now you're bringing this up. So the Challenger Series and the Master Series, presumably it's like a feeder series in Formula One racing, GP2 and Formula One. Is there a strong desire? Obviously, everyone wants to win anyway, but is there a requirement you needed to be in the top two or three to be able to be eligible for the next year's masterclass? What is the difference between Challenger and Masterclass? Is it just a little bit quicker, or can you describe how much more effort it would require?
Yeah, so the Masterclass was obviously the top of the line. They were Formula One, whereas we were like, I don't know, Moto 2 or GP 2, whatever you want to call it, Formula 2. And yeah, I mean, obviously we were all aspiring to get there. But the way they selected the people wasn't necessarily just on merit or on accomplishments or winnings or losings. It was sort of on availability, sponsors. You know, it's a business nonetheless. So it wasn't you know, Daniel Riefer and Flo Berger are like, and have been the fastest challengers, you know, since it was introduced. And I think given the opportunity, they would have been a lot faster than some of the master guys, truth be told. But they were never pushed through. I can't tell you why. But for me, it's a business for them. They need to look at how they can get viewers, people's social media, you know, their following that they have, and how you know, they present themselves and how they sell themselves. So that's one aspect. You asked me about, is it a lot faster? Yeah, it is a lot faster. They were allowed to go to 12G. We were only allowed to go to 10 for a period of 0.05 of a second. You know, you get penalized anything over that. They were allowed to make modifications on the aerodynamics of their aircraft. Obviously, the aeroplane set up for one person. Sure. You know, we had, I think it was 8 pilots, one of which was a media pilot, so 7 racing pilots, and we had to share 3 aircraft. So, you know, you sort of, you got one guy at 6 foot and another guy is 5'10", and, you know, so you sort of had to pick the best setup that would work for everyone because it's a TV production. So it was a quick turnaround. So, yeah, that's obviously a negative side. If you've got your own shoes, they fit better than your mate's shoes. You know, it's just one of those things. But they also allowed to go to 2,950 RPM. We were only limited to 2,700. And you actually get penalized. So this information was transferred back to sort of race headquarters, and they were monitoring everything from oil temps to CHTs, EGTs, because we obviously were allowed to lean in the edge as well, but we were only allowed to lean to a certain temperature. And if we went over that, we would be disqualified because we could possibly damage the engine. So, yeah, and the other aspect, obviously, is the entrance speed. So, you know, through the entrance gate, we were allowed 180, which is a ground speed. Okay. So, obviously, you know, your wind comes into play as well, whereas they were allowed 200. So certain aspects, those aeroplanes could turn on a ticky. You know, the edges that we were flying were also really good, but yeah, not quite as tight as what the masters were.
Okay, so you mentioned nicely, Rodney is joining us asking about the different aeroplanes. So you guys had 3 to operate on, and in the masterclass, is it can they modify the aeroplanes? Are they all using the H540? But is it, can you do your own things to a degree, like Formula One?
Yeah, they're very limited. So engine and prop were standard, and Red Bull actually carried spares as well. So if they had anyone that had a problem, they would actually give the engine so that they had everyone flying. Mika Brigeau and Matt Hall were actually flying MX aircraft. I know Matt changed to an Edge quite late. I think it was in 2018 after he had an issue. You know, a structural issue with the MX. And, I mean, those guys were able to take the aircraft home, play around with them. You know, if you look at Yoshi's aeroplane in relation to any other Edge that was racing there, you see how, like, weird the canopy looks and the turtle deck and stuff. He did massive amounts of changes. And he also had, a MacBook inside there, which was, like, logging data for every flight. So, I mean, the guys really went to town. Okay. But yeah, they were limited in certain aspects, and especially on weight as well. Mm-hmm. But everything else they could fiddle around with.
Sure, and like Formula One and lots of professional sports. If the team had a budget 10 times the size of the next team, did that result in better performance generally?
It did, but that's why they put the limit on the prop and the engine, to try and make it a little bit more sportsmanlike, so that, you know, it was also down to the pilot rather than, you know, just having, you know, the biggest horsepower engine. Yeah, when they started, think Hannes Ochs plane that I actually did the first training camp in that I flew had a plate on the engine, and I think it was something like 450 horsepower, something silly. Sure. Yeah, so I mean, to get that sort of horsepower as a tiny little plane, you know, it also starts becoming a question mark with reliability and things like that. So I think from safety as well as to keep it a little bit more competitive, they put those parameters in place.
Okay. Now, just before we get to the what's coming next, I'm going to show a video clip shortly, and it's going to show you on the podium. So you've had a couple of pole positions, and you had some podium finishes. Tell us what that's like. What's the feeling like getting on the podium there? Or before that, you get pole position for this race. What goes through your mind when you realize you've done that for the first time?
Yeah, it's quite a different sensation, because you actually don't know how you've done until they tell you on the radio. So, you know, by the time that you've gone through the finish gate, it's like you're sort of a bit sublime to the fact that it's gone that well, and you think, oh no, you know, I've messed it up, or, you know, I'm sure I didn't have that line correct. And then Steve Jones would come on the radio and said, oh, Challenger 77, Davidson, your pole position, well done, you know, and it's like, wow, okay, cool. But I tend to have a bad tendency of doing that one day too early. So it would have been cool if I got those pole positions on race day. That would be cool.
Tell me a bit, before we get to what's coming now with the World Series of Air Racing, tell me a bit about your family joining you on these things. I know you've got a young child, you mentioned at the beginning, a one-year-old. Have they been able to be exposed to your flying? Have they gone with you? Have they been flying with you in aeroplanes? Have they gone around the world on your air show events, your air race events?
Yeah, my oldest daughter, Mackenzie, she's six now. When I started the air race, myself and my wife Liana made a decision that, you know, I would have done it for free. It wasn't for me. It wasn't about the money. It wasn't about anything. I just wanted to fly. And, you know, as I said to you, that was the pinnacle for me. So we decided to utilize that money to travel as a family together and to see the world. And, so she was with me at pretty much all the races in 2018. And, you know, she was exposed to, you know, traveling with me, obviously behind the scenes. Red Bull are actually amazing in that regard. You know, a lot of people, you know, sitting on the sideline might see it to be an idealist where, you know, they've got these top athletes, or, you know, top people at the top of their game, and that's all they want. But they're actually massive family people as well, which is pretty cool. It took me a bit by surprise. So, you know, when it's time to work, it's time to work. Obviously, they need you. You know, you got to be there, and you got to be available, and they're not looking for any distractions. So there was restrictions for them being around the race airport and stuff. But they were welcome to travel with me, have dinner with me, and, you know, be around. And obviously had passes for all the places, and got to know and hang out with all the other families too. So Mackenzie traveled with me initially. Taylor's only one at the moment, so she unfortunately missed the boat on that one. But yeah, both of them have flown from a young age. I mean, the youngest now I think was 2 weeks old when she flew, and I think Ken's was like 4 weeks when she flew for the first time. And Mackenzie quite enjoys doing aerobatics with me in the RV, so I don't know if I've created a little monster.
You're going to see what it's like to be your father in a couple of years' time. It's great to involve the family, and it's nice that you can give them an opportunity to travel with you and experience it. So the big question then, Patrick, what is coming? I know there was talk of something special brewing in September, if I'm correct, and COVID has now put the brakes on that for the moment. But what's happening in the future with the racing, in air racing particularly?
Yeah, I mean, it looks as though Red Bull Air Race as a product, with maybe some changes, has been bought. There was a press release not so long ago where the World Air Race Championship had been approved by FAI, which is the governing body for aviation sports, powered and non-powered. And everything was full steam ahead to sort of get going in September. We've had no formal correspondence with regards to say, Patrick, you are actually physically going to be racing. So I'm wishful, because I'd give anything to get back racing again. But But yeah, there is something on the cards. We don't know too much about the formats, who will be involved, the Masters, the Challenges. We're not exactly sure. But it seems quite far along in the discussions. But the COVID-19 thing has obviously hit the anchors quite hard. So sure. I don't think anything's going to happen in 2020, to be blatantly honest with you, in most things, not only just this. Sure. But yeah, I think 2021, fingers crossed.
Good. Well, thank you, Patrick. It's been wonderful chatting with you. I've really enjoyed getting that behind-the-scenes insight and understanding the dynamics and the discipline, etc. Thanks so much for your time, and thank your family too for your time today. And I wish you all the best when it does go flying. And next time I'm in Port Elizabeth, I'm going to look you up.
You're welcome, bro. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, cheers, Patrick.
Thank you for listening. I'm excited to have you on this journey with us. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and remember to subscribe to the show to catch weekly episodes so that you can build your high performance team.